Hi, folks. This is Warren Hunt with another episode of the Guitar Podcast. Thanks for tuning in again. This is episode number 87. 87.2, I think. 2.0, something like that. Because, well, last night I recorded the whole thing. Hour plus of footage. Answering questions, talking about feedback, and reading emails, and all kinds of cool stuff. And I get to the end, and microphone was not on. It was set at something else. Oh, the joys of a new computer. So, I was not happy. Not happy at all. So, anyway, without further ado, I guess here we go. For those of you new to the Guitar Podcast, I want you to know that when I talk about guitars and amps and pedals and music and all, I'm conveying my opinion from my experience and learning over the years. Please email me with questions at info@theguitarpodcast.net. Check out the show notes. Follow the Guitar Podcast on Facebook. Last but not least, go to theguitarpodcast.net and sign up for email alerts where you'll get emails notifying you when a new episode has been released and other timely information regarding the Guitar Podcast. You notice how I say theguitarpodcast.net or info@theguitarpodcast.net? Well, you may remember last year about this time, I was trying to get a hold of the domain theguitarpodcast.com. Well, and the guy I was talking with who owned it was asking a ridiculous amount of money for it. And I was like, no. Not going to happen. Well, folks, patience has paid off because the URL became available again and went to auction, and I won the auction and only paid maybe about twice the amount of a normal domain fee. Not very much. And so it hasn't been actually turned over to me, hasn't been processed through you know, the whole thing, get it to me yet, but very soon I expect to have theguitarpodcast.com domain in my calloused fingertips. I love it. So when that happens, I'll let you all know. But I'm going to keep guitarpodcast.net, but I'm going to have most everything move over to theguitarpodcast.com when that happens. It's not happening now, so don't change, don't look for it yet. But not all the podcasts will stay on .net because going through iTunes and redirect and all that stuff, it just can be a real headache. And I didn't really know what I was doing when I started this thing, so everything's kind of crazy. And it's all held together by duct tape and baling wire and guitar strings and stuff. All right, so. Enough of that. Tonight is Halloween. So last night I recorded this, and it was, you know, Halloween Eve. And it was, I thought I did a great job, so I'm going to try to measure up to that. I know it's going to be tough. But, yeah, I've eaten a bunch of candy, which may help. I've developed a cold today, which is going to work against me. But please bear with me. All right. This week, I'm going to talk about all kinds of email feedback, a correction, and some funnies, and all sorts of different things. First off, I want to start with an email from Brent, who is adding more information backing me up on my last correction about skunk stripes on Fender Stratocasters and Telecasters and so on. He starts with, "Lauren, when I first heard you say the thing about skunk stripes, I was going to say something, but I decided against it. I had just sent you the email about Paul Reed Smith tone, and I felt like I was being a pest. With the exception of vintage reissues, all of my rosewood fretboards have skunk stripes. The following is from a book, The Fender Stratocaster, by A.R. Duchossois, and I know I'm probably pronouncing that wrong, but I'm guessing that's French or something like that, so I say Duchossois. So, A.R. Du Chausson says, between 1954 and 1959, the exclusive trim was a fretted one-piece maple neck without any separate fingerboard. The skunk stripe was necessary to install the truss rod. The introduction of the rosewood fretboards in July 1962 and maple slab fretboards, the truss rod could be installed before the fretboard, eliminating the skunk stripe. However, for what I guess to be consistency in production process, at the end of the 70s, Fender started to systematically install the truss rod from the rear of the neck, no matter the fretboard style. As a consequence, rosewood cap Stratocasters also featured the walnut spot above the nut and the skunk stripe on the back of the neck. Well, thanks for that, Brent, and I'm really glad you sent that, and don't ever worry about being a pest, okay? Always just give me, if you hear something funny or you want to share something, email me, info@theguitarpodcast.net. Man, I'm glad to share it. Really appreciate it. I never think you're going to be a pest, okay? Something funny, and I've read this like a handful of times. Of course, this is at least the second time I've read it because I read it last night, right? But whenever AR says that the rosewood fretboards were introduced in 1962, it's kind of odd because somebody is wrong somewhere because I held a 1960 Stratocaster last year, a little over a year ago. That had a rosewood fretboard, and they said it was a 1960. And I was like, well, I didn't think they came out with the rosewood fretboards until 1962. So either they didn't have the right date, or, well, I'm sure A.R. Du Chausson knows much more about strats and Fenders than I do, but so I don't know. You know, I always thought that 62s were... Anyway, I do like the fact that he kind of... This article kind of backs up my theory of the necessity to have the skunk stripe, the consistency of skunk stripe on all their instruments due to production process, kind of like interchangeable parts with the old Ford Model T So, you know, there you go. So, thanks a lot, Brett. My next email comes from Leo, and I love this. This one's called Blues Rules. I'd like to say it's the rules of the blues, the do's and don'ts, the ins and outs. And it's a list of about, what is it? What do we have? 15 rules of the blues. Okay, it starts out. Many blues songs begin with "woke up this morning." This is to differentiate blues musicians from most other musicians who sleep past noon. The nice thing about blues is that once you've written the first line, you're pretty much done with the second line too. when I was a kid, I kind of didn't like the blues because I thought, man, they're kind of copping out for that second line. They could totally embellish the story a little more with something different for that second line. They just said the same thing as they did in the first line. And your phone's getting on my nerves, interrupting my podcast recording. Chevys and Cadillacs are blues cars. Other acceptable blues modes of transportation are as follows: a Greyhound bus, a southbound train, as opposed to a northbound or eastbound or westbound, or just plain walking. Unacceptable modes of transportation for the blues: any non-U.S. car, Volvo, Fiat, Honda, Land Rover, etc., completely unacceptable. A touring bike, a cruise ship, a motor scooter, rollerblades, or the back seat of a limo. Obvious reasons why those would be unacceptable. teenagers shouldn't sing the blues until they're old enough to get the electric chair or life without parole because they shot a man in Memphis. You can have the blues in New York City, St. Louis, Chicago, Tupelo, and Kansas City are other good blues towns. You cannot have the blues in Vail, the Hamptons, or any town whose name ends in beach. Now, shot in the back by a jealous lover is a blues way to die. So is the electric chair. It is not a blues death if you die during liposuction treatment or by cell phone radiation. You have the right to sing the blues if you're blind, you shot a man in Memphis, you can't be satisfied, or your mojo is working. Just for legal reasons, I want to state that we do not, here at the Guitar Podcast, we do not support you shooting a man in Memphis, or shooting a man anywhere. We're not behind this, we do not support this, and do not recommend this as a requirement to necessarily be a blues man. Okay? Just to clarify. All right. You do not have the right to sing the blues if you were once blind and now you can see. You shot an 85 at golf. Your dad left you a trust fund. It's right after your lottery number hits. Good places for the blues. A highway, a jailhouse, an empty bed, or a freight train. Bad places for the blues. Yellowstone National Park, a country club, gallery openings, indoor tennis courts, a Mercedes-Benz dealership, Starbucks, or Hawaii. Now let's rewind. The gallery openings or something like that. I will say that, say it's middle of fall, early winter, and it's a Sunday afternoon, and my Colts are playing a game, and I'm at a gallery opening, and I can't watch the game, then, yeah, I think I'd have the blues. Okay, if you ask for water and your baby give you gasoline, that's the blues. Other blues drinks include wine, whiskey, and, of course, muddy water. Blues beverages do not include any drink with a little umbrella, any wine kosher for Passover, Yoo-hoo, all flavors, Jello shots, or an iced decaf latte. Now then, the all-important picking a blues name. Start with an affirmity, like blind, or little, or fat, or lame, or old, or magic, or clubfoot. Add Willie, or Johnny, or Joe. Pick a U.S. president. Washington, Johnson, Fillmore, Roosevelt. Persons with names like Ashley, Brittany, Chad, Kimberly, Sissy, Brad, Buffy, Tara, Tiffany may not sing the blues, no matter how many men they shot in Memphis. I would guess that a guy with the name Lauren couldn't really do the blues either, because that's not really a kind of a blues name. So, with that in mind, I kind of need to come up with my own blues name. So, I'm not blind. I've got really good eyesight. I'm not little. I'm kind of average. I'm a little overweight, but I'm not fat. You could go like skinny, but I'm not skinny. Definitely not skinny. Old? I'm not magic. I'm getting old. So I could go with old. And I don't know about Willie or Johnny or Joe or anything like that. How about man, like old man? Now that you talk about the last name being like a president's name, like Washington or Johnson or Fillmore or Roosevelt, you know, I totally get that. I totally get all that. But I don't think you could go Bush or Obama or I don't know if you listen to this after the election, if Romney wins. I mean, I don't think you could go like old, you know, Blind Willie Romney. It just doesn't quite work. And, you know, or Reagan. I don't think that works either. Clinton, maybe. Because of that connection with, like, George Clinton, I think you might be able to pull that off. Maybe Kennedy? Ford, I think Ford would work. But a lot of the newer presidents, I don't think those names quite work for blues names. So, like, old man Roosevelt or old Jimmy Roosevelt or something like that. I think that'd be a good name for me. What do you think, honey? Think old, what are, old man Roosevelt or old Willie Roosevelt? I think Roosevelt, Roosevelt would be a good first name too. Like Skinny Roosevelt Washington. I like that one. I like that a lot. Where were we? All right, so I get an email from Chris in Sydney, Australia, which is always awesome to get someone from another country, an email from somebody from another country like Australia or anywhere in Asia or South America or something like that. Heck, Mexico or Canada would be cool too. Anywhere outside of Indiana is really good. So, what? I know that doesn't make any sense. It doesn't matter, right? Okay, so Chris says, "Hey, Lauren, saw you have some fresh posts on Facebook, so I'm assuming that you are back on the air. Good to see. I had a silly idea. Have you ever heard of TalkShoe.com? It's a podcast conference call system. Works okay in my experience and is easy to use. It has a fair share of crazies and Christians. Some fit into both categories, but other organizations use it, such as the VoiceOver IP Users Conference, VMware, etc., with good success. If you wanted, you could use it to do for a moderated listener involvement podcast. Do some Q&A, get some live feedback, general chat, etc. They have a area code in 724, that's Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, I think. A dial-in number for regular phone calls as well as a web client so anyone around the world can call in. Have a look, see, and have a look. And if you're keen, drop me a line, and I'll be more than happy to help set you up. Keep up the good work. Looking forward to your next podcast. Cheers, Chris." Thanks, Chris. Some good stuff. It's really, I will look into it. But the thing is, I guess what's bigger is, you guys tune in and listen to you download the podcast or listen to it online or whatever. It comes to your iPhone or your Zoom or whatever, and you listen to it. And I get a little, some emails and so on and so forth. But would you really want a live chat with me? I'm just curious about that. Let me know what you think. Either email or post on Facebook if you think that'd be something you'd want to do. So, because most of what I do here, I talk off the cuff. Really, I don't do a ton of research for most of my answers. It's usually right off of out of my mind, and I am out of my mind, of course. But I just wondered. So. But thanks for that. Chris sent an earlier email. Said, "Hi, Lauren. Just a quick note to send my condolences for the loss of your father. My thoughts and prayers are with you. I also wrote you to say thanks for the efforts on the podcast. I've been working back late listening to them and thoroughly enjoying the info. It's helped me clear up a few things about playing guitar and gear that I would not have found out as easily as I have on your podcast, let alone even consider them. Introducing myself, my name is Chris. I live in Sydney, Australia." Big thumbs up, by the way. "Although I grew up in Canberra, I'm not sure where that is. I'm a bass player. I've played semi-professionally on and off for years in pub bands. Run night jams and work the odd gig and festival stage manager, occasional sound tech. I built a smallish sound system for a few years ago. I also have a pretty extensive background in electronics and did gear repair for a couple of music stores, amps, keyboards, rewired odd guitars, etc. Never went full-time with music as the market here is much too small and I didn't have the intestinal fortitude, I will just throw that in there, to head out overseas to pursue the dream. Speaking of never too young to start, I have, as a part of my midlife renaissance, which I love that term, midlife renaissance and not midlife crisis, jumped into guitar. I've clocked up thousands of hours at bass gigs, but I did my first six-string gig since I was 15 at age 46, around 12 months ago. I had just over 2 weeks to get a 45-minute set of original music I didn't know together. It was a truly humbling experience. Overall, it went well. There were a few notes, a few solos, and a few songs that belonged in other solos, and other songs in different keys. It's funny. But nothing too bad to throw me, although I did get that adrenaline kick that made me feel flight rather than fight. But as my mate who came along to watch said, "You stuffed up like a true professional. You just kept going." He also said, "In the 10 years I've played with you, I've never ever seen you looking so nervous on stage." As I said, truly humbling. You know what you should be doing at the executive level, and the surroundings are all too familiar. But what are you doing? But what you are doing is so unfamiliar and wrong, like a dream where you go to work in your undies. It's just uncomfortable. I've now almost got a dozen gigs notched up now and don't feel quite the same swarm of butterflies I did then. Anyway, if you want to cover some more stuff on bass, one of your podcasts, re-gear, tone, technique, headspace, etc., I'm more than happy to jump online and chat. I work voice over IP now, so a radio quality wideband phone connection to the U.S. is not an issue for me. So if you wanted to record an interview or just have chat online, I'm up for it. Thanks again, great info, lots of good head stuff. Cheers, Chris. P.S. What's the difference between a full-time musician and a pizza? A pizza can feed a family of four. P.P.S. What do you call a full-time musician without a girlfriend? Homeless. P.P.P.S. You've prompted me to go looking for 70s Gibsons on eBay. And you know what happens when you start looking. Yes, Chris, I know exactly what happens when you start looking. You go, "Oh, man, I'd like to have this. Oh, I got to have this. I must have it." And then you're, you know, asking your wife for forgiveness. I know how that goes. Big time. So, I appreciate your offer about interviews at the bass and stuff. Well, might look into something like that. I do have several friends who have extensive experience with bass that are nearby. It'd be fairly easy to chat them up. But it'd be kind of neat to get a perspective for somebody from another country and add some spice to the conversation, because, you know, you won't have an Indian, a Hoosier accent, you know, like me. So thanks a lot, Chris. And I'm gonna file this away for the talkshoe.com and check it out. Oh, I heard a joke today. Why do you never hear of anybody hunting hippies, honey?
I don't know why.
You ever tried to clean one of those things? Yeah, there's a reason why they call them dirty hippies. I think it's funny. Ah, funny. No offense to any hippies out there. I've been guilty of being one, too, back in the day. So, all right, here's an email from Ron. He says, "Hey, Lauren, I just found the guitar podcast." I'm going to make this bigger. "Hey, Lauren, I just found the guitar podcast through one of my Android podcast apps. Can't remember which one. I've listened to 10 to 12 episodes and have really been enjoying them. I love the variety of topics. I'm a pastor in South Bend, Indiana." Are you Catholic? The Irish? Yeah, sorry, I digress. "And play electric on our worship team. I've played since I was a teenager, 35 now, in a couple serious bands and always loved rock and metal. And even if I don't get to work out those muscles on a Sunday morning, I remember some time ago someone asked about how you liked playing a worship team, and you contrasted it to playing in bars. In regards to a church setting, I'd love to know, 1, how your playing differs on a worship team versus a bar band, and 2, how you approach your tone, gear in a worship team versus a bar band. I find my setting, the guitar needs to mix well with everyone instead of being upfront instrument. I recognize every team is different in that respect. Finding a good distorted overdriven sound that meshes well with a keyboard, bass, multiple singers, etc. can be a challenge. I've used a pod, but I didn't like being not able to hear myself in the monitors. We don't have Evioms. I then moved to modeling amp and some pedals to find modeling amps really don't handle the pedals that great. Apparently, the additional input messes with the digital circuitry. So I took some of my pedals to the local guitar center and found a nice solid state amp they work nicely with. It's on layaway currently. If money were no object, I'd have a Marshall Class 5 or something, but two kids and one on the way mean pinching pennies wherever I can. I've played long enough to recognize that what sounds good when I'm practicing alone can sound like garbage when I'm with a band. I don't turn the gain up to 10, suck the mids, and expect to sound good. I tweak quite a bit during practice. There are some pretty general rules I found. You don't need nearly as much gain as you think you do unless you're doing deathcore, worship, screamo, or something. And generally, a good sound is something you practice and then go, this sounds great. For me, it has to have more mids and highs than I'm used to using when practicing alone. I don't know if the same has proven true for you, but I'd love to hear your thoughts. Keep up the good work. Blessings, Ron. Matthew 6:33. Thanks a lot, Ron. Some pretty good feedback. And you know what? I agree with a lot of that. Because it's funny. Whenever I'm playing in my bedroom or whatever, and I want the bass way up on my amp, and I've really gotten used to having the mids there. But occasionally you scoop them, and you want to flex those muscles, those old school metal muscles, right? But you're absolutely right. In most band situations, unless you're doing, unless the guitar is the featured instrument and you're playing metal, you don't need to scoop the mids and have a lot of gain. So you ask how my playing differs on a worship team versus a bar band. Well, in a bar band, most bar bands I was ever in, I was either playing exclusively the lead guitar and rhythm. There's one guitar player in the band, so I had to cover a lot of ground dynamically and stylistically and volume and all sorts of things. So if I played less, that said one thing. I played more, you had to build it up. Or there was another guitar player, and then I could play a little less. I could back off and stuff. Whereas in a worship style band, there are at least one other guitar player and maybe an acoustic guitar player, maybe two acoustic guitar players and another electric guitar player, and then your bass and drums, of course, and multiple vocalists and a keyboardist and sometimes piano along with it. And then we have backing tracks with beats and different sounds and stuff. So I play a lot less. There are plenty of times I'm listening to it and I go, I have no business playing during this part. I'm just going to stop and I'm going to tap my foot or clap or sing, I mean, they don't put a mic in front of my face, but I still sing and just kind of keep things going that way. Another thing that is different, that whenever I played in bars, it was a lot more physical motion on stage than, on stage at my church. So I still move. I still want to engage people and move around, but different kinds of movements than you would do maybe in a bar band. Things that aren't quite so, you just want to be a little more humble, I guess, in the movements and not draw quite so much attention to yourself. But the thing is, you still need to engage the audience. So movement, motion on stage is important. So now, how do you approach your tone gear in a worship team versus a bar band? Again, I totally agree with backing off of the overdrive, pushing the mids up a bit more and maybe, I don't know about the treble so much, it's the mids, and maybe backing off the bass, because the guitar really sits in the mids. So taking it away, you're almost muting yourself. You know, whenever you're playing with a piano and a keyboard and other guitars and all the vocalists and everything that's going, you know, you really do want to have that nice mid, that mid range. So I agree with pretty much everything you were saying before. And I played through the pods. They were kind of easy, but they didn't quite have any soul. Wasn't quite like playing through a tube amp or anything like that. And honestly, I'm not sure how much you were spending on a solid state amp. I mean, as long as it sounds good, that's all that really matters. But I'm a big fan of tube amps, and I seriously think that you could probably find a used tube amp for decent money. And I'm not sure what the budget would be. And I totally understand the penny pinching thing whenever you have, you know, two kids and another one on the way. Congratulations on the other one on the way, of course. So I hope that helps out, man. If you need some follow up on that, you know, you want some more clarification, if I didn't cover quite as much as you'd like. One other thing I was just thinking was, when I played in bars, I had a very minimal rig. For a while there, I plugged it directly from my guitar right into my amp. No tuner, no volume pedal, no nothing. No wah, anything. I just rocked it that way. And then a wah pedal came in. And then a volume pedal and a wah pedal came in. And I would just tune to the bass player. And, you know, I'm tuned close enough. This is rock and roll, right? And so I really didn't have any delay, no reverb on the amp. It was in overdrive was really controlled with my volume knob. I would roll that back to try to clean it up a bit and pick softer and control dynamics a lot that way. Whereas if you're playing something like Chris Tomlin music or Lincoln Brewster, you need to cover a lot of ground, and having a good delay pedal in the mix is very good to have. And playing with so many other instruments, I definitely have a tuner on my pedal board. I'm, you know, always checking that, being sure that everything is right in tune, perfect. Of course, I'm not drinking beer on stage or taking shots of whiskey given to me from audience members, which is quite a bit different from, you know, being in a bar band. None of that happens. So, obviously. And, what else? Yeah, my effects pedal board is much bigger, has much more stuff on it than I did. I had a very raw sound. Of course, I do still kind of, and they kind of like that about me. We'll be talking about parts that we're playing in each song and stuff. And they're like, Lauren, you got to be the guy doing, I want you to hit this hard. I want that beef, you know, that big beefy tone, you know, big, just hit him in the face. And I love doing it. So, I typically have more overdrive than the other guys. And it's not that it's, you know, like the distortion is cranked to 10. It's usually anywhere between 3 and maybe, let's say 10 o'clock and maybe 2 o'clock, right around in there, just depending on which amp I'm running into. So, you know, and I try to cascade my overdrives into different levels so that I can have one that's just barely pushing the amp and another one that's pushing it harder and another one that's like over the top. And of course, the first one would be the clean boost, and it's after the other distortion pedals. So, yeah, like I said, hope that helps out. If you want some more clarification on any of it, fire another email at me. All right, we got an email from Rob, and he says, "Hi, Lauren." Oh, this is in response to episode 85. This morning, I got your email and heard episode 86. It's in response to episode 86. Sorry to hear about your dad. I'm glad to hear that you have much support and were able to spend good time with him. I understand having to get back on the podcast in life. When my dad passed, I had a work project to finish. It was very important to me to get back on the horse, and it helped a great deal. I really miss my dad and had no way saying that everything is instantly better, but I find little things that keep me moving forward are a tremendous help. I think you will, too. Take care, Rob. Rob, the occasional bass player and singer dude. P.S. I agree. Avoid crazy people. Yeah. So, thanks a lot, Rob. You know, and I have to apologize to the audience that I tried to jump right back in, and I was recording stuff during the time, you know, going to and from the hospital, trying to keep that up, and then and I put that episode out, and I thought, you know, I'm going to keep it up. I'm going to do it like normal, you know, put out an episode a week, maybe more, because for a while there last summer, in late summer, I was putting out more than one a week occasionally. But, you know, I got that one out, and I got to sitting down thinking, I'm going to put out another one, I'm going to record another one, and it just didn't come. I just wasn't feeling it, and, you know, I hope you all understand, but I'm glad to be back, and I have a lot of stuff. I've got a backlog of emails to read and respond to, posts on Facebook where people are asking questions and commenting, and I want to comment back on here, not just there. I've got some things I want to talk about that I've read in some magazines and other things that are going on in you know, guitar world, not the magazine Guitar World, but the guitar world broadly. So, anyway, yeah, I want to be back on it. So, thanks a lot. Thanks for your understanding. And thanks for the email, Rob. David writes, Lauren, thank you very much for all the great info. I took guitar lessons in 85 and 86 and learned the basics. Then went off to college, got caught up in life, and quit playing. Now I've picked up the guitar again, and your podcasts are helping fill in the blanks I've missed in the last 25 years. I've listened to about half your podcasts in the last week. In episode 56, Tone Change, EVH, Protect Your Ears, while talking about tone, you mentioned tight bottom end, just enough brightness, solid middle, not scooped, nice classic rock tone. You go on to say that you don't want shrill tone or muddy, mushy tone. Could you please give us examples of nice classic tone and then other examples of what not to do, a too shrill tone and muddy tone? I'm a newbie and really don't know what muddy tone sounds like. I know what I like, but I trust your ears more than mine. I think listening to what you think is good would help me and hopefully other noobs to train their ears. Again, thanks for all your hard work. Greatly appreciated. Regards, David. This is a great question, David, because, yeah, we guitar players use a lot of adjectives and strange ways to describe what aspects of tone, because our voices really don't emulate it very well. Most of us don't. There are some very talented people out there who can, and I could attempt it here, but... I don't think it'd be a great idea, and I'd probably lose like all my listeners if I did it. So, a tight bottom end, it's just low, it's the bass frequency. You want to, I recommend having enough bass so that you hear that, a good rumble, that you can feel it. But not so much that it rumbles everything. That's what the bass player is for, right? And the kick drum is for. So just enough, and like I was saying earlier, whenever you get in with a band, it's a different thing, because you may turn. I like having my bass like on 10, and sometimes backing it, you know, my amps back down to maybe 8 or something like that. But if you're playing like a Mesa Boogie, a dual rectifier or triple rectifier, those things have so much bass response. There's no way I would have that on 10. It's just way too much. And then at that point, what do you need a bass player, right? And we all need bass players. And you don't want to make the bass player upset because, you know, you need a bass player for crying out loud. When you talk about just enough brightness, that's where I'm talking about treble. So a lot of times, say if you're playing hard rock or metal and you want that distortion, the more treble you put in there, the more distortion your ear, a young ear or a ear that's not well trained, senses. So if you have too much treble, it would get really shrill and piercing to your ears, and it sounds, and it makes the distortion sound really fizzy. It's just not a good thing. So what I recommend doing is backing the treble off, say back down to about maybe 10 or 11 o'clock, and gradually bring it up until you just barely hear it. I know I'm going to use another adjective that might not help a lot. When the sound starts getting just a little crispy. I know. I just used another one that doesn't make any sense. But when you can just start to hear it, and you go, oh, hey, that's kind of nice. Sit with that for a little bit, okay? Mid-range is really something that's really tough to get, because there are some guys who use a lot of mid-range, and others like Metallica, or other metal bands like Pantera and Screamo and Nu Metal, that will pull the middle all the way out, and you have like all bass and all treble and no mid-range. And it gets a really cool, distorted sound, but it doesn't fit well with most other situations, unless that is the kind of music you're going to play. So, you know, with those explanations, you talk about, you reference when I talk about nice classic rock tone. What I recommend you doing is getting a hold of, like, Lynyrd Skynyrd, Allman Brothers, you know, Eric Clapton, Jimmy Page, Eric Johnson, magnificent tone there. Someone very similar to Clapton and Eric Johnson is kind of a blend, with just a little more distortion. Joe Bonamassa, all those guys, listen to their tone. And, Black Crowes have great guitar tone. I love their tone. It's real raw. There's typically not a lot of reverb or any kind of effects or anything. It's just great, solid guitar tone. And I'd like to say classic rock tone. But you can take that classic rock guitar tone and put it in any modern rock band and you go, oh, that's cool. What's the guy's name who plays for, good grief. I can't even think of her name. Leaving Las Vegas chick. What is her name? I can't even think. He's a great guitar player. Great, great tone. Started out 65 amps. Anyway, I know you're listening to this going, Sheryl Crow. Sheryl Crow's guitar player. And I can't think of his name. And I know you guys are out there going, is it Peter Stroud? It is Peter Stroud. I think it's Peter Stroud. If it's not, you can air smack me across the face. But I think that's who it is. Guy has great tone. Okay. If you like Sheryl Crow's tunes, some really great guitar sounds there. But the thing about it is, you can't just turn on those those songs on the radio or whatever, or on your MP3 player, CD player, record player, whatever, and just listen to it at a moderate volume and really kind of get that tone. You got to turn it up a little bit. Okay, it's got to be a little louder. Not like blasting your ears out where your ears are ringing like crazy and everything, and annoying the neighbors. But loud enough where you start to hear other pieces of the guitar tone and the other instruments a little more, and start to separate the different parts. So, you know, really it just comes down to listening to those masters of tone, quite a bit. And thinking about that whenever you're playing guitar, and experiment with dialing on your amp and, you know, and on your, you know, distortion pedals, if you know, overdrive pedals, if you're going that route. But it starts really with the guitar and the amp. I recommend just plugging directly into your amp and start messing with the dials, and going to a guitar store and talking with the guitar guys there, plugging into some amps. I'm looking for some good classic tone, some good solid tone for this is the kind of music I like to play. This is what I'm going for. I'm really trying to train my ear about tone and pitch and all that stuff. And I, you know, guys love to talk tone. And, well, like me, you know, I know all these things about guitar and amp and tone and all this stuff. So, you know, I got a podcast. Well, there's tons of guys out there just like me love to share what they know. Okay? So I'm hoping this helps, but man, just listen to that stuff. All right? Well, hope that helped. Thanks a lot for the email, David. Numbskull about last night. I'm recording that. But this one's getting recorded for crying out loud. This is from Ryan in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. I think Ryan's emailed me a few times before, which is awesome. Ryan says, "Hi, Lorne. Once again, love the show. I really appreciate the time and effort you put into it. Anyway, for the last couple weeks, I've been thinking a lot about guitar finishes. I've recently purchased an American Stratocaster with the Olympic White finish, and I know that they use polyurethane finishes on them now. Like you, I like the worn look on Fender instruments, but I would feel dishonest if I bought a new guitar that looked that way. Ha ha. This is a personal hang-up and not a judgment on your decision to relic your Stratocaster." Thanks. "I know that in the 50s and 60s, Fender used nitrocellulose finishes on their guitars, so I was wondering if the polyurethane finishes they use now take longer to wear down, or if they wear differently, or perhaps not at all. I was also wondering why old Fender guitars often look more worn than old Gibson instruments. Someone told me that the nitrocellulose finish is a bit softer and could be polished back to a like new sheen. And I've noticed this on my 61 reissue, but if both Gibson and Fender were using nitro in the 50s and 60s, that should apply to both brands of guitar, right? Finally, I wanted to have my Stratocaster professionally refinished with a nitro finish like the 60s models. Would that detrimentally affect its value, especially far into the future, like 30 years from now? Thank you so much for your time. I'm really looking forward to your next episode. Ryan, Oshkosh, Wisconsin." Well, I'm going to kind of work backwards through your questions and stuff on here. First, thanks. I'm looking forward to the next episode. Sorry to make you wait so long. Anyway, in regards to the value of a Stratocaster 30 years from now, 30 years from now, I don't think it's really going to matter. And I don't think a 2010 or 2012 or this era of Stratocaster is going to ever be considered like golden era or anything like that. If you got a custom shop all done up, you know, like a closet classic, it hasn't been worn or anything like that, you know, maybe it'll hold its value or increase or whatever, but I don't see, you know, your off the shelf normal, you know, nitro finished, you know, Strat, you know, gaining the ground like a 60s or, I mean, 50s or 60s, certainly. And even though the 70s guitars are going up in price now, over the last 7 years they've been increasing. Of course, they were kind of a black eye on Fender for the longest time, and look now, they're, you know, I've seen prices on some of them double in the last 5 years. But, you know, when I look at that, I'd say, you know, refinishing it to make it wear naturally which is what I think you're going for, which I think is noble, and I think it's awesome, and that's really the way to go. Especially if you plan to hold on to this guitar a long time. 30 years is a long time. And, you know, if you're going for that, then I'd say that it's that you're wanting to have a guitar that's the body's tone resonance is going to be better than with, you know, a thick finish. So I honestly wouldn't be too terribly concerned about the value dropping. In some people's eyes, the value would increase with a professional nitro finish. I would prefer a nitro finished guitar over a poly guitar or any other type of finish. Honestly, just it's thinner, it breathes, it's better. I mean, if you're thinking, you know, you just sell it a couple of years, you might have a little bit of a harder time with some potential buyers than others. Other potential buyers would be like, oh, that's awesome. Love the look, love the feel, love it that it's nitro and not the, you know, so on. So I think I've covered that. I'm going to the very beginning here. The nitro finishes definitely wear down and they're thinner and they check and they look really cool as they age. The modern finishes, for the most part, they're not going to wear. It's going to take a lot for them to wear. And polyurethane is a very, very durable finish. It's just a great finish. And the thing is about polyurethane is it can be applied in a thin layer and really protect it. I mean, look really nice for a long, long time. It's very durable and still not, you know, have this really thick shell of paint or you know, on your guitar. Although they put a very thick shell of paint on guitars. But, you know, there are other materials that are actually worse than a poly finish. But if you want it to age, I don't think poly is really the way to go. If you know somebody and you've seen, if you know a professional painter, guitar refinisher, if you've seen their work and you're very pleased with it, it's like, this looks like it's straight out of the factory, then go for it. Because a nitro finish will age, will check, will, you know, do what you want it to do. And it'll age the way you're playing, where you rest your right hand, the way you pick, if you pick real hard or if you go all over the place, or, you know, it'll work well for you. And that's, I mean, I think it's great that you want to do it that way. I was kind of wanted to do that with that 54 Strat. I was doing, I mean, it was wearing, but I just didn't play a whole lot on it as much as, say, like the guitar I played in high school. I wore that thing out in a lot of ways and had, you know, marks on the fretboard all over the place, and it was great. But I mean, most of that happened within just like 2 or 3 years, but it's just because I played it all the time. It was the only electric guitar I had. Whereas, you know, now I'm kind of a handful. So, you know, I spread it out. I don't have the time to sit and play, you know, 2, 3, 4 hours a day like I did back then. And, you know, my age, carpal tunnel in my right hand, it's probably not a good idea for me to do that anyway. On the point of, this is really interesting to me, though, where you talk about old Fender guitars that bringing the polish back to, like, new sheen and so on. So, you know, I whoever said that, I don't know if they've done that or if they could show you that they've done that firsthand or if this is just hearsay. Because I know, honest guitar players, we know everything, right? But I had a 74 SG, and it was kind of dingy, and I started to try to clean it up. And what happened was that lacquer started clouding up on me when I used a guitar polish on it. And I don't recall what I did, if I just kept on buffing on that to get it, get it right or if I just gave up or what. I mean, it looked fine, and I don't remember what I did there, but my GNL, it's an 85 GNL, and it is checked all over the place and worn and chipped, and it is just awesome. I love it. And it makes me think that they sprayed it with nitro. So, I mean, it could have been something else for all I know that checked up pretty well. But it was dingy, had sweat marks on it and everything. It was nasty. So what I did was I tried to clean it up with polish and everything, and it just clouded all up. And I freaked out. I was like, oh no, what's going on? I tried to buff it, tried to do, you know, add more polish. It didn't make it better at all. It just reinforced the cloudiness. It was just bad. So at some point I just said enough's enough, and I got a mild soap on a washcloth, just not a lot of water, and I mean just barely damp, a little bit of soap on it, and I cleaned it up, and I had to use a clean damp cloth over and over and over again to be sure that I had all the soap off of it, and then I buffed it out with a dry cloth, and it cleaned up just fine. And I'm never putting guitar polish on that guitar again. But I mean, it came out looking okay. I'm not saying it's a showroom floor sheen. It'll never get back to that. But you know, that was my experience. That it was tough to get it. You know, it was a tough lesson to learn. But I'm passing that on to you all that I don't think taking like a buffing compound or buffing wheel or guitar polish to a dingy old nitro finish is going to bring back that shine. I really don't. I don't think that's going to happen at all. Also, the difference between Fender and Gibson nitro finishes, and this will be purely speculation, the Fenders were sprayed in California, a very dry environment where they would dry really quickly, and they may have had even a thinner coat of a thinner layer of lacquer on them than the Gibsons. But it's a much drier environment. That may play into it. They also may have been getting their nitro lacquer from another manufacturer than Gibson. And then you look at Gibson. Gibson was making their guitars up in Kalamazoo, Michigan, which can be a moist environment, a much more humid environment than, you know, Southern California, which is borderline desert. It's very dry out there. I know that from just a bit of experience. That when I in 83, summer of 83, I spent 2 weeks out there, and my skin got so dry. I was only like 11 years old, and it was very dry, and I didn't quite get it. That, you know, I mean, I grew up in Indiana. You know, we have 100% humidity in the summertime. You know, there's no lack of moisture usually here in Indiana, and Michigan's just one state up, and we vacation there in the summertime. So I mean, it's just as humid up there as it is here. So I wonder if that played into it, that maybe the lacquer took a little longer to cure up, and that might have been made it more solid, or maybe Gibson put a little thicker lacquer on there that they don't wear as much. However, I have seen where Gibsons they fade. Like if you look at old 58 and 59 bursts, some still retain their cherry sunburst. But whenever they get into honey bursts and stuff like that, those aren't necessary. They weren't made to be honey bursts. They were made to be cherry sunbursts, and they've just faded, either from the sun or age, and so on. And you know those finishes that you know they've worn too. But you know I haven't seen the same kind of checking for the most part on those old Gibsons that I do on old Strats and Tellys, but. I mean, I have seen checking on those old Gibsons, but just not quite the same. And typically, I've seen a lot more checking on the old gold tops, a lot of checking on gold tops. They're so awesome looking when they get all checked up like that. You know, I hope that helped. But I guess in summary, I wouldn't worry about the value going up or down from refinishing the guitar. The one thing I would say is, if it's not a polyurethane finish, if it's something else, it may be nearly impossible to get that finish off of that body. And I would research that to be absolutely sure that it's a polyurethane finish or something of that nature that'd be easier to for your guy to strip that finish off and start over, because otherwise he's gonna get halfway into it and go, or not even halfway into it, just barely into it, and go, this is gonna cost a lot more because it's nearly impossible to get this stuff off the body. So I'd be sure about that and let him know and talk with him extensively about that. But otherwise, heck yeah, go for it. But brings me to another thing that I don't want to talk extensively about right now, because I really want to talk about that on a future episode. But Fender is making guitars now to 50s and 60s specs with nitro finish and measurements and everything put together pretty much the same. And I know that's probably going to, I mean, they cost like $2,000, $2,500, and it's just ridiculous that, you know, you have to spend that kind of money to get something that good. But, I mean, part of it's marketing, part of it's, well, you know, you look at trying to get the equivalent in a like a Paul Reed Smith, you're talking that kind of money too. So, but, you know, straight from the factory, it's just like that, and it's going to wear. It's going to wear just the same. So there's that to think about. So Ryan, I hope that helped, and thanks for the email. I didn't say this in the beginning like I did last night when I was recording this, and it's always crazy to do the second time around, but I have a movie review for you. It's not real long. It's just just a handful of minutes. It is The White Stripes, and you know, whether you like The White Stripes or not, I think there's some value to be had by the review and some of the things that I found very interesting from watching the video. I like The White Stripes. I think they're very creative. I like their approach to getting their to tapping into their creativity. And they cover that. It's really cool. But I intentionally saved this for the end of the episode because, you know, if you just plain don't want to hear it, you can always hit, you know, skip to the end or skip to the next episode or whatever you want to do and not listen. But, you know, I do recommend listening. It's not like you're going to hear a bunch of White Stripes music and me talking about how awesome Jack White is, all that stuff. It's not going to be like that. But anyway, I hope you enjoy it. I did. I liked watching it, and so there you go. All right, folks. So this week, going to talk about, to kind of do a little review on The White Stripes, Under Great White Northern Lights. It's an hour and 30 minutes, recorded in, or produced in 2009. The description from Netflix, not a sponsor of the show, by the way. In a captivating mix of striking live footage and poignant offstage moments, this documentary captures the White Stripes in 2007 tour of Canada, showcasing one of the world's most famous and enigmatic bands, playing to big crowds and towns of all sizes. The film features performances at traditional venues as well as matinee gigs at unusual places such as a bowling alley, on a boat, and even on a city bus. So there you have it, folks. I'm going to watch this thing and tell you what I think of it, good and bad. Now, and I will say right off the bat, I do dig The White Stripes, and definitely dig their approach to performances and
just kind of wherever, whenever, however, and, you know, and of course, the Jack, you know, would play on any guitar or whatever, you know, that it's not a, doesn't have to be, you know, the highest end, you know, the biggest, top of the line, you know, Paul Reed Smith or anything like that, which is really cool. You know, garage rock lives, folks, still. Well, anyway, here we go. So visually, I really dig the interplay of black and white and the color, a lot of black and white. When color comes in, it's kind of really strong, vibrant, and overwhelming. Really dig it that they're hitting all those small towns as well as big towns in Canada. Apparently, they had a hard time getting into Canada. You have to pay to get in there and stuff. It was kind of a difficult thing for them. And I think it's really cool. And hitting, I mean, like, they just played a show. They were showing them playing a show in front of, it looked like, I don't know, maybe 100 people. That's pretty cool, the band of their stature in 2007. Thought that was pretty cool. Really dig the airline guitar. So they've showed them play guitar, of course, and piano, and now mandolin. And I got to tell you, I know the White Stripes aren't for everybody. If, you know, if you don't like punk, if you don't have a heart for punk or, you know, loud guitar rock or, you know, even, you know, a bit of folk, I mean, that's really what they cover. And that's really where they're coming from, is a garage band approach to punk and just aggressive stuff. And then, you know, then there's this kind of old-time rock, 50s rock, kind of Jerry Lee Lewis type of a feel to it in some areas, as well as folk and bluegrass, which it's funny how it blends it all together, but it's really cool. And but, again, I know it's not for everybody, but I dig it, so I'm talking about it. So there you go. Enjoy. Okay, so there's a really cool segment where Jack and Meg meet with, I think they're Eskimos. And he talks about their culture, asks about their culture, and wants to know about the crow. They tell him about the raven and how they used to be able to speak and different things. It's really interesting about their culture. And he plays a blues song for them, and then he gets to jam with them as they do a song with him with an accordion, and it's just really kind of a nice moment. Something I like is he talks about creativity and what inspires. It's like early on thinking, oh, it'd be so cool to be on stage, and then he's been on stage a lot, and then it'd be really cool to be go in the studio and record something. Well, he's in that a bunch, so, you know, what's the inspiration from there? And what he's saying is that, you know, just letting creativity come to you, you have all the time in the world, it doesn't really cut it. But giving yourself a defined time to get something done, a deadline, like 4 days. He says, like, go in the studio 4 days, cut an album, boom. And he said that, you know, that really inspires him and really gets him going and really gets him focused. And I think that's really cool insight to a songwriting method or creativity, or pulling that creativity out of yourself. And, you know, and being, Jack being a guy who's written, you know, tons of songs, played in front of tons of people, and, you know, how am I finding my inspiration to write new stuff? And he says, you know, the deadlines. I think that's really cool, because I remember back whenever I was trying to write a lot of songs, I was letting it come to me, and then other times I'd really force it and things like that. And I think, you know, it reminds me of those times, that whenever I force it, whenever I said, hey, I'm doing this today, or I'm going to tonight, I'm going to write something or whatever, I think I got better results that way, as opposed to just letting it come, I think, or letting it flow, or having all the time in the world for it to come around. And of course, as you know, I've written songs, but nothing on the level of what a guy like Jack White has. So anyway, I just thought I'd share that little tidbit. Another thing I find very interesting is, you know how girls talk a lot in comparison to guys? I don't know what the ratio is. Something like girls say, like, you know, like 50,000 words in a day, and guys say maybe 10,000 words in a day. I don't remember what it was, but the women typically talk a whole lot more than men. Well, not so much in this case. Meg doesn't talk at all, and when she does talk, it's very almost a whisper. And Jack talks a lot. I mean, a lot. And it's just funny because she's just sitting there looking at him while he's talking, and he's it's funny. He talks a lot, and she doesn't say much at all. So, just an interesting little insight there. And something else, I think I remember when I first started getting into blues, I was listening to a radio show on a Bloomington, Indiana radio station called WTTS in Bloomington. It's a college radio station for, Indiana University. And they played all kinds of cool music. But it was Sunday nights? Sunday nights, they'd have this, like, 3-hour, this was back in, 93 and 94, they would have these, this blues show, and this guy would talk about the history of blues and so on and so forth, and it would just, he'd talk about guys like Son House, and of course Robert Johnson, a lot of Lightnin' Hopkins, and modern blues, and getting into like B.B. King, Steve Ray Vaughan, but really covering the history of blues, older blues, and Delta blues, and Chicago blues, and St. Louis, all over the place. And the guy was talking about like the lost secrets of the blues, and listed these different things that you had to do, to really get in touch with the blues. And one of the things he said was hard work all day long. And that always kind of stuck with me, because at that time, when I was listening to that, I was working a lot and working hard and doing hard work. And for a guy in his early 20s, you could pull that off, but you still feel it. I don't care how old you are, how young you are. You work a good hard day's work, physical labor for 10 hours in a day, and then you come in for, half a day on Saturday. I'm telling you, your bones ache. And anyway, I know it's a little aside there, but Jack talks about how he's trying to make himself work harder. Like his guitar, he likes it, but it doesn't stay in tune all the time, so he's constantly having to fuss with it, or setting things just a little further away from where he might be standing at a certain point in the song, or having the picks in the back of the stage, so he has to run back there and get it, making himself work harder for the music, for the show, and I see that as a connection to the blues, and as a connection to a work ethic of really having to go after forcing yourself to work harder, and that comes through in the music. And I don't care how many times you hear Seven Nation Army, it's awesome. Something I got to add to is whenever you hear a guy like Jack White in the middle of a song scream out "Yeah" or "Woo" or something like that, it's like impromptu. He's feeling it. It came from him. It's like, it wasn't forced. It's like, it's there. Unlike whenever, say, 1990 rolled around and 1991 rolled around and Metallica released the Black Album, and you heard James Hetfield going, "Yeah, yeah," and stuff. It just was not, it wasn't natural. And I thought, it lost a little bit of authenticity with me, of course, and I didn't really like many of the songs on there, so I don't know. The 90s kind of killed Metallica for me, honestly. But that aside, that raw passion and creativity and just musical energy you get from Jack White, it's really awesome. From the White Stripes, that is. So I just wanted to share that quick little thought there. It's not quite on topic, but maybe it is. I don't know. There's a really touching moment later on in the movie. I'm not going to give it away too much, but it's really good. It's really good. It's actually the last scene of the movie. It's really pretty good. It's a good way to end. It's a good way to end the movie. So I guess in summary, if you like the White Stripes, if you like punk music or something with a variety of a lot of passion and fire and just energy, you know, it's a good movie to watch. It's not like they just play through a bunch of songs. I think they only played maybe a dozen songs in the whole movie. There's a lot of nice dialogue and background and good performances and everything. It's not like you're going to get their whole show on the video, but it's really pretty decent show. A lot of blues, a lot of rock, a lot of punk, a lot of energy. So,
The White Stripes under Great White Northern Lights. So, there you have it, folks. All right, so I hope you enjoyed that. And that pretty much wraps it up for today's episode of the Guitar Podcast. Please email me with questions at info@theguitarpodcast.net. Comment on Facebook and so on. Follow there. If you like what you heard today and you subscribe using iTunes or Zune or whatever, if they allow you to write a review or rank it or anything like that, do it. It'd be cool if you did. If you like what's going on here and you want to contribute, like I said a million times before, I'm never going to ask you for money, like donations or anything like that. Not going to do it. It's not me. Not this guy. I'm not that guy. All right. But what I will say is that if you would like to contribute in some way, shape, or form, and there's no money actually out of your pocket going to the Guitar Podcast by doing this, if you're going to buy like an album or a video or something like that from, like, say, iTunes, instead of going directly to iTunes, go to the guitarpodcast.net and click on the iTunes banner there, and then follow your transaction from there. They follow that, and they send me a dime or two anytime that happens, which is kind of cool for me. It's kind of cool for the show, you know, to pay for some hosting and whatnot, and, hey, getting the guitarpodcast.com. Again, don't have it yet, but so that is that. Thanks for tuning in again. This is Lauren Hunt. I want to say trust your ear, and if you don't trust it, you know, trust the masters. Listen to them. They're not going to steer you wrong. And, you know, develop it. This is Lauren Hunt signing off for the Guitar Podcast.